The Alchemy of Air, a Jewish genius, a doomed tycoon, and the scientific discovery that fed the world but fueled the rise of Hitler, by Thomas Hager. Ye instruments, ye surely jeer at me, with handle, wheel, and cogs and cylinder. I stood beside the gate. Ye were to be the key. True, intricate your wand, but no bolts do ye stir. Inscrutable upon a sunlit day, her veil will nature never let you steal, and what she will not to your mind reveal, you will not wrest from her with levers and with screws. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Faust. Introduction. Creatures of the Air. This is a story of two men who invented a way to turn air into bread, built factories the size of small cities, made enormous fortunes, helped engineer the deaths of millions of people, and saved the lives of billions more. Their work stands, I believe, as the most important discovery ever made. See if you can think of another that ranks with it in terms of life and death importance for the largest number of people. Put simply, the discovery described in this book is keeping alive nearly half the people on Earth. Most people do not know the names of either the men or their invention, but we should thank them every time we take a bite of food. Their work lives today in the form of giant factories, usually located in remote areas, that drink rivers of water, inhale oceans of air, and burn about 1% of all the Earth's energy. If all the machines these men invented were shut down today, more than 2 billion people would starve to death. The reason is this. We are creatures of the air. The stuff of our bodies, the atoms that make up our skin and bones, blood, brain, and everything else, comes primarily from the atmosphere. Sometimes the route is direct, sometimes indirect. Carbon, for instance, comes from carbon dioxide, which plants take in and turn into food. We breathe atmospheric oxygen into our blood, and hydrogen reaches us through water, along with oxygen. A substance that cycles ceaselessly among gas, liquid, and solid, evaporating up into the clouds and precipitating down into our mouths. These three elements, carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen, constitute more than 90% of our bodies by weight. You could say we are air made solid. But the most important element in many ways for humans is the fourth most common in our bodies, and the hardest to find in nature, at least in forms we can use. Nitrogen. You can't live without nitrogen. It is stitched into every gene in your DNA and is built into every protein. If you don't get enough nitrogen, you die. It is not only necessary, but more interesting than the other major elements. Chemically, nitrogen is something of a trickster, a bit promiscuous, eager to join with many other types of atoms with various types of bonds in many different ways. Nitrogen gives proteins their twists and turns, and it confers on living molecules much of their individuality and flexibility. Nitrogen spices up the party. The absolute necessity of nitrogen for life leads to a paradox. We are swimming in nitrogen, but we can never get enough. Nitrogen gas makes up almost 80% of the Earth's atmosphere. We breathe it in and breathe it out all day long. But none of this huge store of atmospheric nitrogen, not a single atom of it, can nourish any plant or animal. It is inert, unavailable, dead. Plants and animals, including humans, require nitrogen in a different form, a form scientists call fixed nitrogen. The availability, or more commonly, lack of fixed nitrogen is so important that it serves as a cap on life on Earth, a limiting factor for plant systems and hence for the animals as well, since all animals depend in one way or another on plant eaters. Put in simple agricultural terms, if you can put more fixed nitrogen on a field, you can grow more. Farmers have long been nitrogen experts, feeding their fields with rotting plants, compost, rich with fixed nitrogen, and animal dung, manures rich with fixed nitrogen, and rotating their crops, growing peas and beans every few years because these plants carry bacteria on their roots that make fixed nitrogen available. The secret of successful farming is moving nitrogen around. Over our heads is a vast vault of unusable nitrogen. Under our feet, a limited amount of fixed nitrogen. Nature offers only two ways of fixing nitrogen, getting it out of the air and into living systems. Those special bacteria on the roots of peas, beans, and few other plants, and bolts of lightning. Both methods produce small amounts of fixed nitrogen that accumulate slowly. As a result, humans have always been faced with a shortage of usable nitrogen, like people floating on a vast sea dying of thirst. The problem has grown along with the human population. Thanks to these extraordinary machines, we are doubling the amount of nitrogen available to living systems. This fundamental change has made it possible to feed billions more people than the Earth could support otherwise. But we are also subjecting our planet to a huge experiment, flooding it with nitrogen taken from the air, poisoning rivers and lakes, killing swaths of the ocean, and boosting global warming without any clear picture of what we're doing or how it will turn out. All of this can be traced back to two relatively unknown men and their machine. But the most direct measure of their importance can be read in the lines on graphs showing the increase in human population over the past 100 years. At the turn of the 20th century, the world supported about 1 billion people. Today, we're above 6 billion and counting. If we all ate simple vegetarian diets and farmed every acre of arable land as wisely as possible using the best techniques of the late 1800s, the Earth could support a population of around 4 billion people. In theory, the other 2 billion plus inhabitants should be starving. The natural result of population outstripping food supply, as doomsayers from Thomas Malthus to Paul Ehrlich have long predicted. But despite the extra mouths, we are not hungry. In fact, the average human today is eating better than he or she did 100 years ago, with diets that are both more varied and higher in calories. That is true everywhere, not just in the United States. Yes, pockets of starvation still happen, but it is not because of lack of food. There is plenty of food around. People starve because of problems shipping it to the places it is needed. Instead of facing worldwide famine, we are dealing with a global epidemic of obesity. The reason is a Haber-Bosch system. Haber-Bosch plants are why food today is so plentiful and so relatively cheap. Haber-Bosch machines grow the plants that feed the animals and produce the oils, sugars, meats, and grains that are making us all fat. If you want to know why so many people are putting on so many pounds today, you know where to look. Food, however, is only part of the story. Remember the terrorist bombing of a federal building in Oklahoma? The explosive used was a couple of tons of nitrogen fertilizer boosted with another nitrogen-containing compound. Fertilizer and explosives are very close in structure. So close that one can often be used for the other. With a little chemical tinkering, the fertilizer from Haber-Bosch factories was turned into gunpowder and TNT. That meant that the same discovery that could feed the world could also destroy it. Haber-Bosch technology was used to make the explosives that killed millions in both world wars. Without Haber-Bosch, historians say Germany would have run out of arms and surrendered 2 years earlier than it did in World War I. Without Haber-Bosch, Hitler would never have been much of a threat. That was just the start. The Haber-Bosch technology was also used to make synthetic fuels. Decades before today's energy crisis, Bosch factories were fueling Germany with synthetic gasoline made from coal. Hitler depended on it in World War II, using Bosch's synthetic fuels to gas and lubricate his planes and trucks, while at the same time using Haber-Bosch synthetic nitrogen to make his bombs and gunpowder. The story of synthetic gasoline, including pre-war deals among IG Farben, Standard Oil, and the Ford Motor Company, is also told in this book. I ran across this story while researching a previous book, The Demon Under the Microscope, about the discovery of the first antibiotic. That discovery was made in the Bayer laboratories in Germany, which later became part of an infamous cartel called IG Farben, which was the world's largest chemical company until it was broken up after World War II. Farben was used by the Nazis to produce everything from rubber for Wehrmacht tires to gasoline for Luftwaffe fighters. Farben powered Hitler's mad dreams. Farben's first director, Karl Bosch, led me into the story. I quickly learned that he was a man of contradictions, a business mogul who won a Nobel Prize, and an ardent anti-Nazi who founded and led a most infamous Nazi firm. I also discovered that Bosch is one of the great mystery men of the 20th century. He kept a very low public profile, avoided meetings, seemed to prefer machines to people, and hid away as much as possible in his Heidelberg villa, which he turned into a private playground equipped with personal laboratories, museum-quality collections, and a research-grade astronomical observatory. He hated what Hitler did to his nation, burned his private papers, died a broken man, and was forgotten. As I learned what there was to learn about Bosch, I also started reading about the second man who developed the machine, Bosch's co-discoverer and fellow Nobelist for his work on nitrogen, Fritz Haber. Haber was as public as Bosch was private, a scientist who reveled in attention, sought glory, drank, smoked, partied, hobnobbed with royalty, and loved making an impression in his hand-tailored military uniform. He was also Jewish. I found much more about Haber, the subject of several biographies and even a character in a couple of plays, but he too had his mysteries. How could a man who helped feed the world also be attacked as a war criminal after World War I? What was he doing in a secret laboratory hidden on an ocean liner? Was it really Haber who discovered the poison gas used at Auschwitz? These men were giants of science. Their careers took off after their invention of the air-to-bread machine, and they both attempted even bigger things. They pioneered new ways of doing science, built city-sized factories, controlled world markets, and made life-or-death decisions. In addition to everything else, Haber and Bosch are in many ways responsible for creating the modern chemical industry. Their work is still vital today, not only because we live on the food they made possible, but because we are just beginning to come to grips with the ecological impact of their discoveries. From the beginning, from the time when humans first tamed fire to the time they started growing grain, from the wings of Icarus to the artificial heart, humans have sought endlessly to cross nature's boundaries, to break its limits, to make themselves more comfortable, more healthy, more powerful than nature alone could. This interplay between human aspiration and natural bounds has its own literature, from the myth of Prometheus and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein to superhero comic books and mad doctor movies, and its own field of play. I would call that field of play, the place in which humans test their natural limits and often break them, science. Stories about scientists are often paeans to selfless men and women bettering mankind's lot in a ceaseless march of progress. Those elements are real and are part of the story, but I have tried to create a different kind of book, one that shows what happens when scientific altruism comes head-to-head with politics, power, pride, money, and personal desire. This, to me, is the real world of science.